This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Ancient maps tell us a lot, often more about the people of the age than about land.
So as the libraries accumulated more books and more visual images of things, maps became more encyclopedic.
Retired Illinois Wesleyan University professor Dan Turkla's new book is about Mappa Mundi, ancient maps of the world from the 11 and 1200s. Plus, parents of a former Thomas Metcalf school student are suing University High School in Normal and Illinois State University over a rescinded admission to U-High. The case hinges on how young a person can be and still be guilty of sexual harassment. Correspondent Colleen Reynolds offers us a cross-cultural view of the Feast of the Epiphany, and the Illinois Politics Roundtable talks about that infamous email referring to covering up a rape in Champaign. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. A lawsuit against Illinois State University explores the questions, what is sexual harassment? How serious is serious? And how young can you be and still face big consequences? Tom and Heidi Felstead say University High School in Normal wrongly took back admission to their son. As an eighth grader, the boy created a Snapchat alias account solely to convince a girl classmate at Thomas Metcalf School to send him a nude photo. Then he spread around the photo showing her bottom and thigh to five other boys. When word reached Metcalf administrators, they barred the boy from a school trip and a dance. The matter also went to the University Office of Equal Opportunity and Access. A ruling there caused University High School to reverse its admission decision the day before classes began this fall. The suit claims that's out of scale for the offense, is punishing twice, and makes other legal arguments. The Felsteads want their son admitted to U-High. This is a lawsuit that encapsulates a societal moment. Reporter, correspondent Edith Brady-Lunny joins us to talk about what's at stake.
There are several things at stake, I think, for this young man who was disinvited to attend University High School. According to his parents, he's losing that valuable freshman year at the lab school, and this also could impact his ability to play the sports that he's supposedly very good at. And then I think also for the lab school, it also puts this moment of related to Me Too in the spotlight for them. And they're going to be judged by some court on how they reacted to all this.
And the university seems to be putting down a marker on zero tolerance, even for someone who's young and not fully formed.
Exactly. I think if this had happened even maybe 5 years ago, there may have been a different, more measured response to it. But all of this happening in the shadow, I think, of the Me Too movement, where we want to, as a society, make a point with young men and young women on how to conduct themselves. And the belief by a lot of schools and educators that you can't start too early to teach kids what's appropriate and not appropriate, and that there could be serious consequences for this.
Is it possible that this will not actually be threshed out directly in court, that other issues will prevent this kind of thing from being considered?
I don't know what, you know, what the judge may look at. The parents of this young man have brought it to the state circuit court for a review of the Illinois State University's decision. So it will very much be up to the judge as to, number one, whether he will even review it.
What are the parents alleging in their legal arguments?
Yeah, the parents are alleging that U-High overstepped its bounds by what they call an expulsion of their son. Now, ISU counters that he was not expelled from U-High, that he actually never started there because they rescinded their invitation. So they are alleging that U-High and ISU have violated the Illinois School Code's rules on expulsion. So that will be the first thing to be settled.
Is Illinois State and U-High bound by the school code?
Well, according to the lawyers for ISU, they are not, because they are a lab school. And secondly, they make that sub-argument that he was not expelled.
Does the acceptance letter give any aid and comfort to either side?
I don't think the acceptance letter will be that much of an issue. What will be an issue is the letter that was sent earlier when the parents were notified in the spring after this incident happened that there could be further consequences, that we are imposing these consequences under the Metcalf School Disciplinary Code, but beware, parents, we're still investigating this, and there could be further consequences.
Doesn't the acceptance letter also say we reserve the right to rescind?
I believe it does, and I think they could fall back on that as well.
Why is U-High not actually fish nor fowl here? Delve into that a little bit more. Why might the school code not apply?
Well, according to what the lawyers for ISU say, they are specifically exempt as a lab school in the same way that a private school would be exempt from some of the rules under the Illinois School Code. In other words, some schools are allowed to make up their own regulations for admittance and for expulsion. So they believe they are exempt under the Illinois School Code.
Are there procedural questions, too?
I don't know that there'll be procedural questions if you come down on the side of the invitation being rescinded. If you come down on that side of things, then I think it's pretty clear cut that we punished this young man under the initial guidelines at Metcalf, and we told you, don't be surprised if there are further consequences. If you lay that out, it's pretty black and white that ISU and the Metcalf School had the right to come in and say, we want to impose this greater sanction after reviewing the entire scenario.
Aren't the parents also saying that the school administrators didn't handle it the right way, or that the follow-up investigation by ISU looked at things it shouldn't have looked at?
Correct. The parents are alleging that it was an incomplete investigation and that the investigators relied on hearsay from some school administrators. And they want to go back and have the investigators potentially hear, for example, from the girl and the girl's parents, the alleged victim in this case. The investigators did not speak to her, and her mother initially said she would schedule time to talk with them, but then did not follow up and do that. So they're saying, wait a minute, you don't have all the information to base your decision on.
As in domestic violence cases, does how the victim feel about it matter to the commission of the unapproved conduct?
Right. In this case, the parents of this young man are saying that in order to find him, in essence, guilty of violating the anti-discrimination and anti-harassment code, it has to have been unwelcome conduct to begin with. And they're saying if you talk to this girl, you would find out that it was not necessarily unwelcome conduct. And there was actually a back and forth, albeit at a very adolescent level, between the two.
She certainly wasn't happy to have the photo of her thigh and bare bottom spread around school to five other kids, though.
Exactly. She was not happy with that. But their point is that there was some follow-up emails that they received from the girl's parents that are included in the court filings that say, we feel bad about this. We think the punishment was too severe for your son, and we believe our daughter contributed equally to this situation.
Is sexual harassment something that happens and is defined that way regardless of how the victim comes to feel about it?
Well, I think in this case, the parents are saying, let's make some distinctions between a policy that is written for ISU students and faculty versus children who are in the K through 8 school. Now, the rules are not divided that way. It doesn't say it's not harassment if you are in 8th grade. So they are asking for a clear distinction to be made based on the fact that these were 8th graders that were involved. I think nationally, you know, we've had a discussion about when is a student too young to be considered a person guilty of harassment. I mean, we've had this discussion about six-year-olds giving another six-year-old a peck on the cheek and whether or not that was harassment. The U.S. Department of Education gives educators actual guidelines for this.
And what do those guidelines say?
The guidelines say take into account the age and the intent and what the situation was engaging, whether or not this was a case of actual sexual harassment.
Well, obviously, ISU can't really go back and take a second bite at the apple in the middle of this case, but is that an incentive to do that later on?
I think it will probably be at least a source of discussion for ISU in terms of how the policy is applied to younger students.
Update us on what's next in the case.
First, the judge has to decide whether or not this is even the proper venue for the case to be heard. The lawyers for ISU are arguing that only ISU should be sued in this lawsuit.
And not President Larry Dietz and not Principal Andrea Margaret.
Exactly. And then it should be heard in the state's court of claims, which is where if you want to sue a state entity, that's where you go. So first, the judge has to decide if this is even going to be heard at the circuit level. And then he has a preliminary injunction to be heard that was filed by the parents. They want their son to be allowed to start school and go to school while this litigation is pending. And he also has a motion to dismiss filed by the attorneys for ISU. And that will be heard on February the 3rd in McLean County Court.
Meanwhile, what's happening to the son of Tom and Heidi Felstead?
Well, according to what they filed in court, he is being homeschooled, which they allege is a great inconvenience to their family. They have three other children who attend lab schools, and this has upset their family scheduling and with different breaks and so forth for the educational needs of their kids. And he also is not being allowed to play in the sports that could advance him in that venue as well.
Can ISU argue that the lab schools are there as a teaching environment for college students and only incidentally providing an education for younger students?
Well, and that is part of their argument, is that the goal of the lab schools is actually to form people who could go on to become educators. And they are going to make the rules for the conduct that will be allowed there. And it's a strict conduct that they want kids to adhere to. And I'm sure that they're afraid that there could be some slippery slope here, that if we let this particular case go by and allow this student to be admitted, given some of the elements of this situation. This young man didn't just request the photos. He took a few extra steps along the way here. He set up a phony Snapchat account with an alias and then requested the photos. The other, I think, the non-mitigating factor here for him, too, is that he did share those photos after he received them. So when you look at the entire picture here, I'm sure that they're looking at this as a little more complicated than just we exchanged some adolescent-level photographs.
And one that sends a message to college students as well.
Exactly. Yes.
Edith Brady Lenny, thanks so much for updating on this. Keep us posted.
Yeah, we'll do that. Thank you.
You're listening to Sound Ideas on 89.1 and WGLT.org. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
Support for WGLT comes from Vision Point Eye Center, now offering comprehensive patient-centered medical eye care from the same local doctors that have been serving our community for decades. Now working together at 1107 Airport Road in Bloomington. Details at visionpointeye.com. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up in just a few minutes, correspondent Colleen Reynolds takes a cross-cultural look at the Feast of the Epiphany in Bloomington. The central question in state politics in the last week has been, what is the rape in Champaign? referred to in an email by a high-powered lobbyist with ties to Illinois House Speaker Mike Madigan. The Illinois Politics Roundtable tries to move the needle on the issue that includes lobbyist Mike McLean asking a chief of staff of then-Governor Pat Quinn for consideration in a disciplinary hearing because the worker was loyal and had kept his mouth shut about Jones's ghost workers and the rape in Champaign. Sean Crawford moderates the panel with analyst Charlie Wheeler, IPR Statehouse editor Brian Mackey, and Tony Arnold of WBEZ, who broke the story by FOIA in past emails. Arnold says there remains a lot of unanswered questions, whether the reference is about a sexual assault that was previously unknown, or whether it connects to political sensibilities over a known rape that happened after a person was let out of prison as a part of an early release program under the Quinn administration.
The fact of the matter is we don't know, because the four people equipped to answer what this email is all about and the details about it have not returned calls or emails or social media requests for comment. It actually took a tip to stake out Michael McLean. Actually had lunch at a really nice downtown Chicago steakhouse. My colleagues found out about it and rushed over there and caught him as he was leaving. And McLean said that he wasn't going to answer questions about this email.
And he indicated, too, didn't he, that there might be some discussion going on with prosecutors or investigators in some way?
He intimated that prosecutors have asked him to cooperate in their investigation, and he left it at that. The implication here is that McLean is not cooperating with prosecutors.
Charlie, I want to go to you. You've watched state government for a long time. I think Tony also mentioned that, you know, in all the time he's seen government, this is not something you would normally run across and certainly not something to be taken lightly. Just get your thoughts on what we've heard so far.
Yeah, I was actually totally surprised and shocked because, yeah, I've seen a lot of stuff in state government, but nothing that would indicate that someone actually knew about a rape that had occurred and they covered it up. I mean, that goes beyond the bounds, in my judgment. I guess we're used to, you know, crooked state officials swiping a few thousand here and a few thousand there and acting like boors towards women. But the notion that you would praise someone for helping to cover up a rape, I mean, as I say, it's beyond the bounds. I just, you know, I'm like at a loss for words. And that's the kind of thing that should be investigated. Now, I understand Senator Brady, the Republican leader in the Senate, Bill Brady, has asked the Illinois State Police to look into it. The Champaign County State's Attorney, if indeed this occurred in her jurisdiction, should be looking into it to prosecute. I mean, you can't just sweep this stuff under the rug. It's just horrendous.
And Brian, this came from Governor Pritzker's office, this email, but there's no indication, you know, we don't want to speculate that the Governor Pritzker knew anything about this necessarily. But you did talk with him, and you've also seen some other things that or some other locations where he has spoken. Has he weighed in on this at all?
Yeah, the governor did an appearance a couple days after Tony's and his colleague's first story on this came out, and he was asked many questions about this. You know, what is your office doing? Are you investigating? Are you calling people? His basic answer was he's given the information to the Office of the Executive Inspector General to investigate, and he doesn't really want to go beyond that because he doesn't want to interfere with that investigative process. But he apparently had not spoken to House Speaker Michael Madigan about it at the time, although the speaker did later get in touch with the governor. And I think it's noting not just the governor's reaction, but how some other lawmakers have reacted to this. It took a day for House Speaker Madigan, who, as Tony said, is a friend, and McLean is considered one of his top political co-strategists and confidants. The speaker put out a two-sentence statement saying, "These are extremely serious and troubling allegations. I had no knowledge of the incident referenced in the story and only learned of this today. I encourage those with any information to come forward." And I thought the reaction to that statement was interesting. State Representative Kelly Cassidy, who has been very active on the Me Too issue in Illinois, she said it should come as no surprise that he didn't know. Every single thing that's been revealed has gotten the same response. Not knowing is foundational and fundamental to the entire design of the organization. So, you know, lawmakers used to be very reluctant to come out and criticize the speaker, and now we are seeing an increasing boldness among some to say, you know, this is unacceptable. And there have been this series of revelations over the past few years, not implicating the speaker himself, but implicating people very close to him in terms of harassment and maltreatment of women and other staff. And this is just the latest revelation that calls into question the people with whom the speaker is surrounding himself.
IPR State House Editor Brian Mackey says Senate Minority Leader Bill Brady of Bloomington has called for a state police investigation in the case. Joining Mackey on the Illinois Politics Roundtable were State House Observer Charlie Wheeler, WBEZ's Tony Arnold, who broke the email story, and moderator Sean Crawford.
Claro shot to fame in 2017 after the homemade video she made for her song Pretty Girl went viral.
And I remember my first week of college, it hit 1 million views.
Now that video has over 40 million views. Claro's released a full-length album, and she's touring with artists like Tame Impala. She talks about what it's like to go from recording in your bedroom to a real studio. An encore edition of my conversation with Claro on the next World Cafe. Tonight at 7 on WGLT, Bloomington Normal's public media.
Support for GLT comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The CPB's Community Service Grant helps GLT bring you Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and other programming on which you rely for news, information, and entertainment. Additional support comes from GLT contributing listeners. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, maps of the world. An Illinois Wesleyan University professor shares his love of them and talks about a new book on maps of the 11 and 1200s. This last weekend was the first Sunday after Epiphany. The religious holiday is more prominent in some cultures than others. Here's an example. A gathering at Wayman AME Church on West Olive in Bloomington was more than a service. It was a Latin American celebration of traditions associated with the Feast of the Epiphany. Correspondent Colleen Reynolds reports on the cross-cultural perspective from three Latin American countries.
Go tell it on the mountain, over the hills and everywhere.
That was the traditional part of the service, but before that, church member Kai Ajayi and his daughter Laura's drum call brings the flavor of the Caribbean, connecting Epiphany in Cuba, the Dominican Republic, and Puerto Rico.
Then after that, it's just one. So it's.
Some traditional service elements seemed untraditional. Take the Agape Dancers and director Lindetta Alsbury's instruction to everyone in the church pews.
Then we'll go back to the beginning, so let's try it. Ready? Holy, holy, holy.
Featured speaker Jesse Dixon Montgomery is an associate professor of Hispanic Studies at Illinois Wesleyan University. Dixon Montgomery says for 30 years, Cubans could not celebrate Christmas or the Feast of the Epiphany, usually on January 6th. It marks the visit by three kings to bring gifts to the Christ child.
Los Reyes Magos, the wise men who traditionally visited Cuba, did not come bearing gifts because of the government of Fidel Castro's revolution of 1959, which abolished all religious holidays since they were against communist principle.
Dixon Montgomery says the ban on religious celebrations changed after Pope John Paul II visited Cuba. She says children now mostly receive toys from charities because so many live in poverty. In the Dominican Republic, Christmas has become a bigger celebration as expats who fled the revolution and settled in New York and New Jersey return to the island with a more American emphasis on gifts and a big Christmas Eve dinner.
Family members gather together and have great Dominican food, including the roast suckling pig, pasteles, which are like tamales, Mexican tamales, but they're not made out of a corn base, usually plantain, or it could be yam, or it could be yuca.
Dominican children do not receive gifts until the Day of the Kings, January 5th. Children put water and grass under the Christmas tree for the camels as the three kings pass in the night and every child goes to bed. In Puerto Rico, the Christmas season begins in late November with carolers singing barandas, secular songs, as they travel their neighborhood. Dixon Montgomery says the season ends with a big parade and the three wise men traveling the island.
They take their National Reyes caravan across the island starting the first week of January so that they're able to share with everyone the true meaning of Los Reyes, the Epiphany, and of course give gifts to kids all around the island.
Lord, we thank you for this time of fellowship together. We thank you for learning about your wise men and how they celebrate in the Caribbean. And God, we just ask that you would bless each and every one that's here today.
In the audience was Bloomington Ward 6 Councilmember Jen Carrillo Gomez. She was born and raised in Mexico City and migrated to the U.S. as a child. Carrillo Gomez says maintaining traditions helps immigrants maintain identity and connection to their roots.
The wisdom and the magic and the rituals of our ancestors are an essential part of who we are, an essential part of our identities, and they are the things that help us make friends into family members and houses into homes and cities and towns into real communities.
Carrillo Gomez thanks church leaders for providing a space to share traditions. She says too often immigrants have to abandon customs when they come to the United States.
Not only do we have to leave our ancestral lands and our families, but we also have to give up parts of ourselves to be able to have a life here. And so it is important that we move with intention and that we create spaces such as this one to begin to share with one another so that we can make ourselves and each other whole in community. I want to encourage us to keep doing this.
Dixon Montgomery agrees events such as the Caribbean Cultural Connection help build important ties.
I think we're at a point now where we just feel people are so different. They're nothing like us. We don't want anything to do with them. They look different. They talk differently. And so I think we need to find some connection between.
Dixon Montgomery has only been a Bloomington Normal for 4 months, arriving from Galesburg, where she taught at Knox College. She says it's been a mostly welcoming community, but she has found subtle racism.
If they never experienced it, things have gotten better. They're not like they used to be in the 60s, and someone told me that. And then when I started recounting different personal incidents, they said, okay, we see the division. We see why people are not quite as happy as we thought they should be. It's not that I have experienced big things. I've experienced some things in subtle ways that make you say, people still aren't coming together. People are still afraid and don't know one another, and they're afraid to reach out.
The longtime teacher embraces any opportunity to raise cultural awareness, even about the Spanish language.
There's also a tendency in our community to label any Spanish speaker either Spanish or Mexican. And I want people to know that there are a lot of Spanish speakers in 22 countries, including the United States. There are a lot all over the world, and they bring valuable traditions and valuable values to the pool. So I would like for more of us to engage in that type of thing, understanding maybe instead of building walls, we can break down some walls.
Dixon Montgomery says, just like a sister city's relationship with a foreign country, exposure to people in this community who don't look or sound like you promotes understanding and an appreciation for the differences and what they bring to the great experiment of a democratic society.
Y'all with me? Y'all with me?
I'm Colleen Reynolds.
Epiphany was January 6th. This is 89.1 and WGLT.org, and you're listening to Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Maps are wonderful things. They tell us about the world, sure, but they also tell us about people. Dan Turkla is a retired professor from Illinois Wesleyan University. He has a new book about Mapamundi, Maps of the World. It focuses on English maps of the 12th and 13th century. Turkla says those were the centuries the maps reached their peak in design, manufacturing, and presentation, and the amount of information they represent, and they represent how the people of that age saw the world.
They tell us quite a lot about the relationship between books and maps, about the theology of the time, because they were almost all made by clerics of some sort, monks or secular clerics. They tell us about the Roman heritage, the Roman history that lies behind these Christian maps. They're all Christian world maps. So it's medieval. Western Europe in the Middle Ages was Christian.
Even though the Romans left, you know, more than five centuries before.
Right, but there are vestiges of Roman maps and the Romans, Julius Caesar, for example, appears on one of the monumental world maps, the only one left that's in Hereford Cathedral. And he commissioned a survey of the known world and sent out four, they were called agrimensores, men who were conducting a survey of the world. And so there are references like that, and pictorial references and verbal references, references in books to Roman cartography. Not many, but there are some. So they tell us, the maps tell us, they show us the world as conceived by scholars of the Middle Ages.
How do they change from the 12th to the 13th century?
They become more elaborate. They become more detailed. All the ones in this book, the seven most important surviving medieval maps, medieval world maps, are shaped the same. They're all circular. They knew the world was a sphere. They didn't think it was flat. They're all, the maps are all circular, therefore to represent that in two dimensions. They're all encircled by what's called the ocean river. They all represent three land masses, Asia at the top, Europe on the left at the bottom, and Africa on the right at the bottom, because these folks, no one had ever gone
west,
south of the equator or west or east. And so they represent the three known land masses and the people's places and events that were important in human history and geography. But their main purpose isn't to be geographical.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Dan Turkla, Emeritus Professor at Illinois Wesleyan University, about his new book, A Critical Companion to English Mappamundi of the 12th and 13th Centuries. How much change is there between these maps and pre-Norman conquest maps, 1066?
Well, some of these are. There is one in here that's pre-Norman conquest, about 50 years maybe before the conquest. And it looks rather different from the other ones. It's almost square. And the ones, it and others, are what we might call more sparse in terms of the information they convey. In part because the libraries and monasteries and abbeys weren't very well developed in 1066 or the middle of the 11th century. So as the libraries accumulated more books and more visual images of things, the maps became more encyclopedic. They are visual encyclopedias in a way.
What's the coolest thing about them for you?
They're idiosyncrasies. So they're all, the maps in this book all rely on the same set of what today we would call cartographical conventions. So they're instantly recognizable as world maps, but every single one of them is completely different in what it focuses on, what it represents in images and in words. So what's fascinating for me aren't the similarities between these maps, but the differences. Because the differences, one of my favorite quotations is from Bill Mitchell, who teaches up in Chicago, and it's every difference makes a difference. So if you look for the similarities first and you get a sense of how the things relate to each other, maybe their chronological relations. And then you start to look for the differences, and those tell you an enormous amount about how the ways in which these maps were used and by whom they were used.
So who were they used by?
Some of the maps from the period were royal maps. So King Henry III of England, for example, had mural maps of the world. He had one in what was then the Palace of Westminster in his great chamber, which is where he would hold sort of official meetings, parliament, if you like. And it was up on the wall near his four-poster bed. He had another one in Winchester, at the palace in Winchester, in the dining hall. And so when he was seated at the high table, he had above him an image of the Wheel of Fortune, and then looking to the east, like in a church, over the entry door, he had a map of the world. Oh. And so that signified his royal power, his royal importance. So there are royal maps. His nephew had a map. His sons had world maps made. So they were used as displays of royal power and authority. The other ones in the book, and most of the medieval world maps, were made in and used at religious houses. So they would be paired with readings, and the readers, the clerical readers, would create mental maps, which became more and more complex the more they read. So they'd have a schematic map of the world in mind, literally. And then the more they read, the more they would add, more information they would add to that schematic map until it became something like one of these encyclopedic ones that we study.
Why would it be important for religious houses to have maps when they are largely economic centers for different local regions and for scholarship and relation to the nobles in that era? They are power centers, but they're economic power centers, and they're political power centers for a given region. They're not global power centers.
Right.
Why have a world map?
Because the more you know about the world, the better your understanding of scripture. And they were power centers, but their basic reason for existing was to either study and understand and kind of imbibe the gospel and spiritual writings. And these maps were a great help in that. And the more a powerful monastery's population knew about the world, the more authority they had when in dealing with, for example, like you said, they were royally endowed often. So they were better able to understand spiritual history, and therefore, I suppose the best way to put it is that these maps, these Christian maps, really won't get you anywhere on the earth, but they all point the way to heaven. And so if you know where heaven is, literally, cartographically, you know how to get to, say, you know where the Garden of Eden is, you know where the city of Jerusalem is. It's often at the center of these maps, literally the center of the universe. They provide you with a visual image of human history and all its faults and successes, and help you understand that history, you can't know the unimportance of that history until you know that history. And then when you understand its unimportance and its faults, then you know the maps will show you the path to heaven. So you transcend human history and move upward.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Dan Turkla, the author and editor of A Critical Companion to English Mappamundi of the 12th and 13th Centuries. He's an emeritus professor at Illinois Wesleyan University. Let's backtrack to the royal maps that you mentioned a bit ago. Of course, kings and rulers want to have things to display that emphasize their power, as you said.
Right.
But they also want to know what they can tax and what they got under their thumb.
Right.
How did these maps do that for them?
They don't.
They don't.
No.
So it's just, it's a political statement.
Yeah, during this time, there were no regional maps. So England, for example, appears on all of these maps, or Britain, I should say, as it was called, Britannia, or Anglia. But there's really no detail. The largest extant, the largest surviving medieval map from the period at Hereford Cathedral represents England, but it only shows London, Hereford, and a small town north of Hereford.
So, I'll bite. Why not? Why not have more local details, since their revenue, their military power, depended on knowing the conditions?
Because it just wasn't important. I mean,
they had this knowledge in other ways?
Well, yeah, I mean, there really wasn't any. After Doomsday in 1066, after 1066, when William the Conqueror had the Doomsday Book put together, they had a really good sense of, it was a census of Britain. So he knew, and then succeeding his successors, knew where the, I don't know, financial powerhouses were, if you like, and roughly how many people lived in what part of the island. So they had a sense of that. These maps, they're really no good for local information.
What would map lovers of today, who don't necessarily have your background in medieval studies, gather from these maps?
Well, apart from just the kind of fascination and thrill that comes from looking at one up close, and the mystery that they present, which is, you know, fun to solve, it's important to understand that every one of these maps is idiosyncratic. Every one of these is unique in presentation, in the presentation of the information, which means that every single one of them is biased. Every single one of them is rhetorical. They're all propositional. They're all pushing a point of view. If you understand that maps have always done that, then you have a better sense of why and how maps today all do that. There is no such thing as an accurate map. Even modern maps, even Google Earth. I mean, Google Earth had my house on the wrong side of White Place. I use it in class. There's no such thing as an accurate map, and every map is biased. And if you understand the ways in which these maps were biased, then you get a better sense of how modern mapping is biased, even digital mapping.
So, for instance, you mentioned some of the biases of the royal maps and the religious biases of some of the clerical maps. What other biases pop out in these things?
They're fundamentally exclusive. They present Christianity in a very favorable light, and they marginalize Jews. They marginalize what used to be called the monstrous races or the monstrous peoples. They're all pushed off into Africa, well away from the center of the earth. Some of on most of these maps, that center is Jerusalem. So they are intensely exclusionary.
Is this an argument that all humans are solipsists?
Well, these certainly are. They're literally self-centered maps from a Christian perspective. I mean, literally. If you think that scholars during this time believed that the earth was at the center of the universe, that it was geocentric. So if you have the earth at the center and you have Jerusalem at the center of a map of the earth, then Christianity is the center of the entire of all creation, literally, geographically. And any peoples who don't fit that mold are pushed literally, figuratively, and pictorially to the margins. They're represented because they show up in, like St. Augustine, they show up in older texts, so they can't be denied a place. They're just put in place on the margins.
How can we consider them as art objects?
Oh, they're astounding. They were made by and with the same made by the people who made books. They're made of the same materials. They're all painted on vellum, calfskin, or some kind of parchment, some kind of animal skin. The lettering is intricate. The hands or the handwriting, if you like, is astounding. The materials used, lapis lazuli to create the blue for the water.
Well, that's pretty expensive.
It's really expensive. Gold leaf. They are some of them. They are my favorite illustrations from the Middle Ages. They're the most elaborate.
As a gauge of economic sunk cost, what would it take to make one of these things in some reckoning of cost that we would understand today?
I have no idea. I honestly have no idea. Nobody does. Nobody knows how much it would have cost. And the other problem is there's no way to convert really currency from 1300 to modern currency.
We're talking hundreds or thousands of hours of scholars.
Yeah.
And calligraphers. We're talking the cost of the calfskin, which was somewhat expensive to produce in that era. We're talking about the cost of the materials used to create it, the lapis lazuli, the gold leaf. I mean, that's a lot.
It is a lot. It is a lot. The elaborateness of the materials is a sign of the importance of the artifact and the importance for the audiences and the makers.
What do you hope people get from this book?
Well, it's written for people who have some sense of map history. But I wrote a preface that hopefully makes it accessible to anybody who has, you know, even the vaguest understanding of what the Middle Ages were and is interested in visual art, in multimedia art. I think it's just we hope that the book is structured in such a way that it'll pull people in who are both, marginally interested in medieval art, medieval geography, medieval history, and then people, scholars in the field.
After this peak of medieval map making that you've identified here in the 12th and 13th centuries, how did maps continue to change and shift in purpose and in technology?
Yeah, that's a great question. The maps in this book are the last generation of maps made before exploration, before what used to be called the Age of Discovery. So the most recent map in the book was made around 1303, right after that. And in fact, right around the turn of the 14th century, exploration started. And seafarers started to make maps of coastlines. So they would draw the coastline as they sailed past it. And then they would mark places for navigation and for safety. They tended to always be in sight of land. They didn't go farther out. Where they couldn't see the land. There was no longitude, so they could never determine how far they were from a landmass. But they made these what are called Portolan charts, which are unbelievably informative and useful for navigation. So we moved from these maps, which, as I said, are no good for getting you anywhere on the earth, to a whole new kind of map that has some elements of the Mappa Mundi, but is really about getting you around the earth, getting you around where... So the Portolan maps changed everything, because accuracy then became important, or something like accuracy.
How have modern technologies helped understand these maps?
Oh, in enormously important ways. There's a group of people who comprise what's called the Lazarus Project. And as you might guess from the name, their goal is to use digital technology, multispectral imaging, to resurrect artifacts and, in our case, text on maps and images on maps that no one has been able to read for hundreds of years. They can scan what seem to be erased or permanently damaged areas on maps, and then we kind of separate the layers of erasure and overpainting and overwriting and allow us to read, to see things, literally to see things on these maps that haven't been seen for hundreds of years.
Illinois Wesleyan University Emeritus Professor Dan Turkla's new book is A Critical Companion to English Mappamundi of the 12th and 13th Centuries. It's just out from Boydell Press. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. Thanks to correspondent Edith Brady Lunny for dropping by to talk about the Yuhai lawsuit as well. Our website is where you can find Sound Ideas, interviews, and stories. You can subscribe to Sound Ideas on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. We want to know what you think about Sound Ideas. Comment on our Facebook page, we're WGLT-FM, or follow us on Twitter. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.